WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Radio Lab listeners, you're going to be very happy with my next guest. It's Latif Nasser, reporter and director of research for Radio Lab, and maybe you know his new podcast. It's the story of another man who shares his name. It's pronounced differently. His name is Abdul Latif Nasser, but because of Radio Lab, people are beginning to learn his name as well. The U.S. government knows his name because Abdul Latif Nasser is in Guantanamo Bay. They know him as Detainee 244. The series is called The Other Latif. It's a new 6-episode Radiolab series that pieces together how the imprisoned one wound up at Guantanamo Bay without trial for 18 years. He's behind bars without trial for all this time. Despite the State Department once authorizing his freedom and his repeated claims of innocence, though, as our Latif Nasser acknowledges, everybody behind bars, almost everybody, claims to be innocent. So this amazing story of a Radiolab staffer discovering that there's this other person with the same name and he's a Guantanamo detainee. Here's the detained Latif's lawyer.
He did not take up arms against the Northern Alliance, definitely does not have extremist sentiment. He didn't support what happened on 9/11, did not have a relationship with Osama bin Laden. He found himself under fire along with a slew of children and families seeking shelter from the bombings.
Just happened to be hanging around in Afghanistan, says the lawyer, Latif Nasser from Radiolab, joins us now. Hi, Latif.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
How'd this all start?
This all started with a tweet. I was just procrastinating at work. I saw a tweet. I thought it was about me. It was from a nonprofit law firm, and they were making an appeal. It was an open letter to then-President Barack Obama on behalf of me. And I was like, what? And then I realized, wait a second, this is not about me. This is about another guy with my same name who is locked up at Guantanamo Bay.
Is it a common name?
It's not really a common name. I've never met anybody with my name. When I go to coffee shops, they always mark down my drink as for Lionel or lettuce or loofah or whatever. No, it's not a common name. Even when I've traveled to Muslim countries, I haven't met other people with my name.
So how did you start digging into the story of Guantanamo Bay detainee 244?
There was so little, actually. There was so little online. The place I really started was with these WikiLeaked documents that are available on the New York Times website. And they're from 2008, so they're kind of old, but they had quite a damning list of things that the U.S. government at that point thought that he did, and they were very serious. Things like that he was a top advisor to Osama bin Laden, that he was the one of the top explosives experts for al-Qaeda, that he had fought against U.S. and coalition troops at Tora Bora, the battle where Osama bin Laden got away and we wouldn't catch him for 10 years. You know, these were pretty damning things about this guy. And that was, with very few exceptions, that was pretty much all that was online.
Can you clear up the pronouncer thing? How do you say your name and how does he say his name?
Sure. I was raised saying my name Latif. That's how I say my name. His name, he pronounces it, and I think other people who are named Latif, which is the Arabic pronouncer. I'm a kid of immigrants. My roots go back to India. So my family, actually, we don't even speak Arabic. So we're Muslims, but I got this Muslim Arabic name. But my family, we didn't really know how to pronounce it. So I've pronounced it wrong my whole life. But that's me.
So have you two met?
Well, I tried desperately. I went to I took a media tour of Guantanamo Bay and put in a request to meet him. But that was turned down. And the grounds they used to turn it down is they said that would be against the Geneva Conventions.
Why would it be against the Geneva Conventions for a private citizen to meet a prisoner, especially a private citizen journalist? Exactly.
Yeah. They said that there's a sort of a clause in the Geneva Conventions that you don't want to put prisoners of war on public display. And that dates back to there was an instance where I think they were Nazi prisoners of war were kind of paraded through a town and ridiculed and that kind of thing. And so the idea is that if we were to interview and do a story about this guy, which I'm doing anyway, that would be putting this guy on public display.
So you were denied an audience with him. Was he interested? Did you get a message to him enough for him to know that you're out there and you have the same name and what you're doing?
Yeah. Through his lawyer, he waived his privacy rights. He said, I'm willing to talk to this reporter with my name. But the detention center there decided that that was not something they wanted to allow. I did get to do another even stranger thing, which is that I wasn't allowed to interview him directly, but I was allowed to go through the detention center, and this is what they do on the media tours, and you can kind of look into the different cell blocks through a two-way mirror, so that the detainees there cannot see you, but you can see them, and it's very eerie. It feels like you're kind of at the zoo, and you're looking at these different exhibits. And for me, there, I was looking for one guy. It felt like I was like looking for my favorite animal or something. It was very strange.
And you saw him?
And I can't be sure. I think I'm pretty sure I saw him. He was sitting on a chair, but he was sitting underneath a stairwell, and so the light sort of cut across his torso. So I could see part of his beard. I could see that he was sort of sitting. He had headphones on, but I couldn't quite make out his face. So I still, to this day, I can't tell whether it was him I saw or whether it was somebody else. I've done all of this, looked at all the photos of the guys who are still there to see, does any of them have that exact beard? Does anybody? And I'm pretty sure that it was him. I got this glimpse of him for I don't know, about 40 seconds. And I just wanted to scream out his name, which is also my name. And I couldn't because I wasn't allowed, and they just kind of, after 40 seconds, they just sort of usher you through. So that's the closest I got to him.
Listeners, if anybody's been listening to the other Latif, we invite your phone calls for this Latif from Radiolab, 212-433-WNYC, if you have any questions, 212-433-9692. So it must be incredibly weird to be kind of this regular American guy, you, who finds that there's another person with your name in this one of the most extreme situations that somebody could be in the world, being locked up at Guantanamo for 18 years without trial or the prospect of a trial. And so you're digging into him, you know, out of your Radiolabian curiosity. And what you run up against is two extreme versions of the same man. So can you go a little bit into detail on that?
Yeah, sure. So the first was the document I talked about, that DOD, it's called a detainee assessment, that was leaked in 2008. And it's as stark as you can get. This guy seems like a monster. It's sort of the blackest black version of the story. And then I talked to his lawyer, and she, as you played earlier, she sort of knocks down these claims one by one. And so she presents him as this guy who is, in fact, sort of an exemplary guy who went over to Afghanistan to help, to volunteer and to help. And so she presents this version that felt like sort of the whitest white. And so these were kind of the only two portraits I had of this guy, and there was no hint of gray in between them. It was so stark.
I've heard episode one so far. Do you come to a conclusion? I don't know if you want to do a spoiler here for people who are going to, you know, binge or listen sequentially, but... do you come to a conclusion, or how much of that do you want to even signal about which version of the other Latif is accurate?
Well, in a way, I need to preface this answer by saying that in 2016, six different top agencies of the U.S. government reviewed his case. He had a parole board type hearing, and they unanimously decided that he is no longer a threat to the United States. We no longer need to keep him, and he should go home. So in a way, because they have, you know, higher security clearances, access to intelligence that I don't have, in a way, I feel like I have to defer to their judgment. Mm-hmm. It's whatever he did, it's no longer grounds for us keeping him. That said, this question of, is he innocent? Is he guilty? Did he do these things? Did he not? That has obsessed me for the last 3 years. And in a way, what I hope is this series is sort of chronicling that obsession, kind of showing my work as a reporter, so that then listeners can kind of come to their own opinions, come to their own ideas.
And it puts Guantanamo back on the map for a lot of people. With all the other issues going on in the country, it's not something that people talk about very much. But here is this legal limbo that so many people think is completely unfair, almost no matter what the guy did, of you're behind bars for 18 years. There's no prospect of you being released that seems realistic. And at the same time, they're not going to try you, which goes against all the values, at least, you know, until what we've been talking about recently about the justice system and how it's being personalized, what we thought of as American values. You're behind bars, you're entitled to a trial, and maybe you did the worst thing in the world, you know, committed terrorism in the name of Osama bin Laden or something like that. And then you get punished, but you're entitled to a trial. But that's exactly why Guantanamo Bay exists, because it's offshore, so it's not subject to those rules, right?
That's right. And for me, when I first found out about this guy, I mean, I was in this place where I was like, oh, Guantanamo, that's still open, that place? Mm. And then to kind of have now sort of after this long reporting quest, I've sort of dug in, and what you realize is, yeah, we created this place purposefully where American laws would not apply, where international laws would not apply. We created this place that was, as the phrase goes, the legal equivalent of outer space. We created this place where our laws and our values were not supposed to apply. And that's where we took this guy. That's where we have held him for 18 years without a trial, without charges, where he has been tortured. His lawyer has said that he has said multiple times, give me a trial. I want a trial. I'm ready for a fair trial. I will very happily take that. And that, I think, It's not about him whether he deserves a trial. It's about us, whether we think that the rule of law, that due process is an important enough value that we think that everybody deserves it.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking to Latif Nasser from Radiolab, whose new 6-part Radiolab series is called The Other Latif. It's a guy with the same name as him, who he was explaining to us a minute ago. He became aware of through a tweet that he thought was aimed at him, but it was really aimed at the other Latif. And the other Latif turns out to be a detainee for the last 18 years at Guantanamo Bay. So our Latif dug into his story. We'll continue in a minute with another clip, this one from episode 2 of the series, in which even though our Latif couldn't meet the other Latif, he did get to meet members of his family in Morocco, and we'll play a clip of how that went. And we can also take your phone calls if you have any questions at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Latif Nasser from Radiolab, his new 6-part series, The Other Latif. Let's take a phone call. Lutra in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Lutra.
Hi, good morning, Brian. How are you?
Good, thank you very much.
I'm from Afghanistan, city Kandahar, but I'm a Hindu. But the plenty of Latifs was in the school, so every class has a Latif. They call Muhammad Latif, Abdul Latif. So there was plenty of, everywhere there was a Latif, like a city in Kandahar, but not in the Kabul. But that's why some city they put a name like cousin knows Latif, he put the Latif.
So
I don't know in the Kabul.
So if we were doing this story in Afghanistan, it wouldn't be so unusual to find another Abdul Latif Nasser.
Yes, right. Absolutely, yes. Maybe some Afghanis listening right now, but the city from Kandahar, so maybe they're going to call you. I'm from Kandahar.
Latif, you want to say anything to Lutra?
Yeah, the interesting thing about that is that Latif is one of the 99 names of God in Islam. It means the most kind, the most gentle, something like that. And so my parents, they found that name in a Muslim baby name book, and so they named it to me. But when I went to Morocco and I traveled a bunch there, what I realized is that it's sort of taboo. It feels a little sacrilegious to be named just Latif. It's like if in America, if you were named your kid God or something.
Yeah.
So instead, so mostly people who have this name are, as he's saying, Abdul Latif, which is servant of Latif, or they have another prefix to kind of make it a more acceptable name. So my name is in a way the more unusual one. That's entirely right.
Yeah, a little different, yes.
Lutra, thank you so much for calling. Chris in Edison, you're on WNYC. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Brian. I've been a listener for a while, and it's kind of cool that I got through. And I just wanted to share that I was stationed in Guantanamo Bay in the early mid-2000s. And I think it's interesting that he makes this point that he was told that it's a violation of the Geneva Convention to sort of put prisoners of war on display, which... it's a contradiction in a lot of ways because they're not given Geneva Convention rights most often, or that, you know, legally the argument is made that they don't deserve Geneva Convention rights because they're detained combatants, they're not uniformed troops, you know, they don't belong to a certain country or a formal army. But there's also been lots of people that go down there. One time there was a beauty pageant winner that got a tour of the detention facility, and I worked in what I imagine is probably like what's considered the supermax facility that I think that he went through, where there's like a dimmed rotunda area, and you walk around and there's these two, you know, large panes of two-way mirror glass, and you just can look in there and see what's going on. The whole place is built for observation, and people are given tours all the time. The ICRC goes in there very regularly and interviews detainees for humanitarian reasons. Congress people go in there. But also this, like, beauty pageant winner was given a tour for who knows why. So that's very silly. And then I can tell you also anecdotally, there was at least one other prisoner I know of that we fully were aware that he posed no threat to the United States government, had maybe did or did not harbor any ill will towards us, but didn't participate, wasn't a combatant, didn't do anything wrong, and more or less was just sold to the United States for the ransom money.
Latif, want to talk to Chris?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I have a million questions for you. I've heard that beauty pageant story. Were you there during that time?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. What was that like? What did that feel like?
Well, I mean, it made the entire job feel absolutely ridiculous. I mean, you know, every single day was, you know, we would 12-hour shifts where we'd walk literally miles, you know, almost a dozen miles in a day. You're just trudging back and forth, walking, and they're constantly telling you to be on the lookout for every single thing, be extremely vigilant, be aware that, you know, at any moment any terrible thing could happen. And then they give a tour of the Supermax facility in this completely isolated location. You have to take a military aircraft to get there. And there's this beauty pageant winner just strolling through.
Sounds Trumpian, but it wasn't Trump at that time.
No, it was Bush, yeah.
I'll ask one, then you ask one.
Yeah,
did you
sure.
did you meet Latif Nasser, Chris?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I didn't remember. I didn't memorize any names or anything. I mean, I have no idea. There are some people that I would recognize. I mean, there were, you know, like, there are people that have been released, and you see their names on the news. You see their pictures on the news, like the years ago when Bo Bergdahl was recovered from Afghanistan from the Taliban, and we gave them back five different detainees. I recognized every single one of them by their faces. But this particular guy, I didn't look him up. I don't know what he looks like, so I don't know if I knew him.
Latif, go ahead.
No, that was the exact question I was going to ask. Maybe I'll come up with another one here then. Which is that one thing I noticed when I went there is that the guards, the guard force, the people who were around there, they had these sort of removable name tags, and they would put on other kind of alias type nickname
tapes. We had numbers.
Yeah.
Chris, thank you so much for your call. It's so interesting. We really appreciate you opening up about some of that. So here's the other clip I promised from the series. This is from episode 2, in which Latif gets to visit Latif's family in Morocco, even though at Guantanamo they didn't let him meet the actual other Latif. So in Morocco, here's a 24-second clip through a translator of someone from the other Latif's family talking to our Latif.
You are like my brother. You are my brother. My brother who was still to come. She said that you are like her brother who are waiting for to come. I see the innocence that's in his face, in his features, that are similar to their brother.
You want to give us the context of that?
Yeah. So I wanted to get to meet this guy's family, and I basically booked a flight. And right after I did, I thought, "Oh God, how am I going to get them to trust me?" I couldn't find any other media interviews they'd ever done before. You know, I'm coming from this country that has kept their brother, in some cases, detained for over a decade and a half, and without a trial. And so I thought, "There's no way they're going to trust me." And when I walked in, it was sort of exactly the opposite. They just welcomed me. They hugged and kissed me. They told me that, you know, they knew that I was coming. They knew that I had his name. But what they didn't know, and that was his sister Khadija. She told me she didn't know that I had his height, that I had his build, that I looked like him, and that I was around the age that he was when she last saw him. And so she grabbed me and she said, call me sister. Aww. And it's because in a way I'd walked into this family that's kind of almost, I mean, their brother just was taken away. They get to see him every once in a while on a video chat, but in a way they were almost in mourning for him. Like he was this important person to them, and he was just gone. And so then here I step in, and I don't even think I look like him that much, but I think it was just so emotionally intense that they were projecting onto me a lot, which made the journalistic challenge entirely different than what I went in expecting.
Where else did reporting Latif's story take you besides Morocco?
The other big trip was to Guantanamo, and that trip was. I've done a lot of reporting trips in my time. That was by far the strangest place I've ever been. Up is down. So many of the questions we would ask were the answers were classified, and then so many of the other questions we would ask, the answers, like I went with a longtime Guantanamo journalist, Carol Rosenberg, and she would just be sort of fact-checking in real time, and she would say, yeah, the thing that this person just told you, yeah, that's not true. It's an entirely different thing. And so
You went with Carol Rosenberg to Guantanamo. She's like from the Miami Herald, right? She's like the best Guantanamo reporter in the world.
She is, and now she's at the New York Times. But she's an invaluable resource. She's done all kinds of terrific reporting, including she had a story of a few months ago in the New York Times that estimated the cost of each detainee at Guantanamo per year. So to give you a sense, like in a supermax facility in the United States, that per detainee per year, it's less than $100,000. Her estimates were that per detainee per year at Guantanamo is $13 million.
Okay, where our tax dollars go. And we're almost out of time, but we have a Guantanamo question coming in. So we're going to take that to wrap this up from Elle in Nassau County. Hi, Elle, you're on with Latif Nasser from Radiolab. Hi.
Hi there. Thank you for taking the question. It's a two-part question. If Guantanamo is in the country, or on the land that is claimed by, I believe, Cuba, and Cuba has not acknowledged the rental of the land. They have not cashed the checks that were given for the leasing of the land. Therefore, what status does the U.S. have in still maintaining the prison, and what rights would a country, a sovereign country as Cuba, have in regards of reclaiming or getting their property, because the land is property?
Elle, thank you so much for the interesting questions. And Latif, we've got about a minute left.
Sure. Yeah, it's a very interesting question that many lawyers have sort of parsed. It goes all the way back to when the U.S. wanted a base in the area to protect their interests in the Panama Canal Zone, but basically the agreement that the United States and Cuba made was one where the United States would get that land for an indefinite amount of time, and both parties would have to want to kind of abandon the agreement for that land to go back to Cuba. So, and the U.S. has not changed their mind about it, and even though Cuba might have, they can't really do anything about it.
And there we leave it. And if you want to know more, folks, you're just going to have to hear the series, the new 6-episode Radiolab series called The Other Latif, or Latif, because these people with the same name pronounce their names differently. Our Latif is Latif Nasser. From Radiolab, and this is an amazing accomplishment, and glad you were able to come on this show and talk about it for a while. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian.